Good evening. My name is Paul Holden Graeber, and I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library. Tonight it is a pleasure to present to you Dead from the New York Public Library. John Crutcher of Bloomberg Press, who is co-sponsoring this evening, will provide you with a proper and timely introduction to tonight's event. John oversees the Economist book line in the U.S. and has helped make Dead come alive as a program tonight. I'm also grateful to The Economist for lending their hand, the paper, as it is referred to, and I'm happy to know that the paper is thinking of helping us with a long life of live events. A round of applause for The Economist. Also, a round of applause to our fabulous wine sponsor, Oriel. They are a wonderful purveyor and distributor of fine wines. Aristophanes, I want you to applaud them twice so that they continue to provide lots and lots of beverages at each and every event, be it live or dead. Aristophanes inspires them to sponsor us. He said back then, quickly bring me a beaker of wine so that I may wet my mind and say something clever. Join their email list, please, so they may offer you wonderful wines for lovers of fine conversation. So thank you to Oriel. Please stay on for the wine reception following the conversation, as well as for the book signing. 192 Books is with us, as always, a fabulous independent bookstore. We love them. Before the book signing and the drink, you are here to ask some hard questions about life and death to our distinguished guests, Anne Rowe, Marilyn Johnson, and Daniel Okrent. Questions, please, rather than rants. A mic will be passed around, and now to introduce them properly, and the evening, ladies and gentlemen, John Crutcher.
It's a great pleasure to be here, and Bloomberg Press is very happy to be co-sponsoring this. This particular project has been the most fun I've had in publishing in some time. And as we've sold the Economist Book of Obituaries into the marketplace, I always feel guilty about describing it as fun, but I think it is. Obituaries are, for many of us, a guilty pleasure. They're an easy way to learn about people, to learn about a time, and many of them are indeed quite fun. Some of them are quite sad. They are of the famous, the infamous, and sometimes of the not well-known, not so well-known, who tell us a great deal about our times and times past. We have a wonderful group of people, but first I'm going to talk a little bit, very briefly, about Paul. Paul Holden Graeber, for anybody who hasn't been here before and who didn't realize it when he just did that, Paul's a force of nature, and I quickly discovered that working with him. And I think it is more than fair to say he is very, very good for books and ideas in New York City. So I'll go alphabetically. Marilyn Johnson is the author of The Deadbeat, Lost Souls, Lucky Stiffs, and The Perverse Pleasures of Obituaries, published by Harper, quite successfully, I may add. She set off, when she worked for Life magazine, as she put it, she set off with tributes, Princess Diana. She did a special fifth anniversary send-off for Jackie O. And she's now working on a book about librarians, writing much of it and researching much of it right here in the New York Public Library. Dan Okrent is clearly a man of many talents. He was the first public editor of the New York Times. He's the author of, therefore, public editor number one. His book, The Great Fortune, The Epic of Rockefeller Center, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in History. And if that wasn't enough, this really makes me feel guilty as a non-participant in life. He appeared in Woody Allen's Sweet and Lowdown, was a commentator in Ken Burns' documentary Baseball, and is to many most famous for inventing rotisserie league baseball. He's also collaborating with Ken Burns on a history of Prohibition, where Dan will be writing the book and Ken will be doing the documentary. and Dan will, of course, appear as part of the documentary. Anne Rowe is the obituaries editor and briefing editor of The Economist, the paper, having previously been American editor and books and arts editor. She's co-creator, I would have called her co-author, but there are a few other contributors to this, to the just-published Economist Book of Obituaries. She's by training a medievalist, which quite naturally and logically led her to work for the BBC. In addition to her wonderful obituaries, she writes in a longer form. She writes biographies, including last year's quite wonderful Being Shelley and a book, Pontius Pilate, all of which are the biography of an invented man. There's a great subtitle. All of which are published by Random House in various divisions. There's a wonderful line in Marilyn's The Deadbeat. It says, "Death is an unstable element. Will it loft someone's reputation or pull the ripcord? Read the obit and find out." Now let's bring our distinguished panel up here to talk about how obituaries are made and why.
Well, a good day for me begins by looking who died. In the morning, I wake up and I see online now mostly, but not only, who died. And if a lot of people that I respect or people that I'm learning to discover through the obituary have died, I consider it a good day. It sounds vaguely perverse, but we will find out that perhaps it isn't, and that many people here in this audience share that passion. Going back home just recently, by home I mean to my parents' house, my father just turned 90, 65 years of marriage and 70 years of continuous work, his greatest, I think, sense of self really comes from having worked now for 70 continuous years. The first thing he gave me when I arrived back in Brussels, where they live, is this wonderful obituary that now we know you wrote, because until recently, until the book was published, we wouldn't have, because the obituaries in The Economist are anonymous. And it is a fantastic piece on Martin Teitel. Martin Teitel, for all of you who don't know, I can't imagine many of you wouldn't know, but Martin Teitel was the last surgeon in New York of typewriters. He could fix any typewriter, and they're wonderful, humane, extraordinary, and I even wore my cufflinks tonight, have some, well, you know, this one says escape, but wonderful, wonderful profile you did of Martin Teitel, and there's a wonderful notation in it of Ian Fraser, who comes to see Martin Teitel about 10 years ago, because on his typewriter, he is missing an umlaut. And he is, and Martin Teitel produces a drawer filled with umlauts. Now,
that was great.
Now, why? I mean, you only have 52 dead people to choose from a year.
Yes, it's
why
true.
Did you choose, since it's once a week, why did you choose Martin Teitel?
I couldn't resist Martin Teitel simply because I love typewriters. And I love also the sense of ages that are passing and last representatives of an age or other. The idea that there was one last person in New York who could find that little bit for a typewriter ribbon or could find a key for a typewriter, it was magical to me, because I think obits are a chance to escape into completely different worlds and different obsessions, if you like. I mean, the fact that this chap, as you say, Paul, had a drawer full of umlauts, and he has a shop which was full from top to bottom with different fonts of alphabets the world over. And this is fantastic stuff to me. And I would rather have done him than any number of more famous people, I think, who died. And sometimes my choices are quite whimsical, if I can get away with it. Sometimes I can't. Ronald Reagan dies or someone, and I don't have a choice. But if I have one, I will go for someone like that. It was just gorgeous to be able to bathe in nostalgia for typewriters. Daddy must feel the same.
Well, first of all, I would like to say I'm not qualified to be here. I don't write obituaries. I read obituaries. I hope one day to be in one. In fact, John's kind introduction mentioned at the end this matter of Rotisserie League Baseball, which is an embarrassment that I've been living with for almost 30 years. And my wife argued that when I took my job at the Times as public editor, it was so that that would be the lead of the obituary instead of Rotisserie League Baseball. I don't think it's going to work. I find what Anne says about Martin Tidal is very meaningful to me as a reader and as an appreciator of obituaries. The death confirms the life. Martin Tidal didn't exist for the readers of The Economist until you confirmed him with that. It reminds me of what a friend of ours said on the death of Kurt Cobain. She said that she was glad that he died because had he not died, she never would have known he had ever lived. And the lives that jump off the obituary page in the Times, which I've been reading, the first thing I read every day, and I have been since I was a teenager, are lives that have filled my life.
Can I also say that the idea that obituaries are uncool, that that's an uncool desk to be sitting at, is completely false. I mean, I think that this is an impression that a lot of people have, but the editor of the obits page at the Washington Post was arguing this and saying people were, you know, looking down their nose at him from the national desk, and he said, "They're covering the dog at the White House, and I'm bearing an era."
Also, in the introduction to the Book of Obituaries that has just come out, you mentioned that The Economist now considers the obituary pages among the liveliest.
Yes, that's true. Well, it's true that for many, many years, The Economist didn't go near obituaries.
150
years. 150
years. That's a lot of life, 150 yes. times 52. That's 7,500 people they didn't
that
cover.
That we missed, yes.
There's a lot of catching up.
There's a lot of catching up, including Gladstone and God knows who. But, yes, I think we felt in those early years that it was too much a page about personality, and we rather shied away from that. But since then, there have been a number of pages about personalities introduced in The Economist, and this was one of the best to do, I think. And it's just turned out an excellent page to bring in. And there's now, I mean, far from being uncool, as Marilyn says, there's now kind of sometimes almost physical fighting to get to write an obituary. When Yeltsin died, I had five offers of all the people who'd been bureau chief in Moscow suddenly on the phone saying, "Yes, I want to do that one. Please, please let me." And they are just such fun to write. They are in no way, well, I won't say they aren't ever sad. They are if it's someone young or someone you feel just hasn't fulfilled themselves. But most of the time, this is a life that's full, and it's the obits are sort of celebration of it or an entertainment built round it in a way.
But most of the lives you cover in this particular book of obituaries are people who died rather old.
Yeah, that's true. Yes.
That's often the case.
It is.
It is. It is. You make a good point.
You were mentioning, Paul, about the 150 years of obituaries that The Economist did not run. And there's something real to that. When the great newspaper strike of 1963 and into, I think, part of 1964, a lot of people died, but their death was never confirmed by the paper. And if you look at you can go online and see the first edition published at the end of the strike had three pages of two-paragraph obituaries, many of them of people who would have been two-column obituaries. And we have a friend, Ben Sonnenberg Jr., whose father was a very important figure in New York, but he never really died because he died during the newspaper strike.
When was the first obituary written?
Well, there's speculation that it was a notice nailed to the door of a pub during the Black Death.
That's cheerful.
That's amazing. And it was the obituary of the landlord or the whose was it?
It was somebody who, you know, sat on a bar stool ordinarily, but was not going to be occupying it again. I mean, I don't know. In England, it came about?
One wouldn't imagine that the lives, Plutarch's lives, are obituaries.
Or, you know, lives of the saints. I mean, those are obits in a way.
In a sense, they are.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Go ahead.
You go ahead,
Dan. No, the distinction between the obit and the tribute, I think, is a meaningful
it's
one.
An
and in
one.
Fact, the English newspapers and the Globe and Mail in Toronto, it's a very, very different form from what we see in the Times.
Mm. What is the difference? Because
or lack of it, I think, sometimes.
Respect or lack of it.
Yes. I think there's a reverential tone about American obituaries.
Why?
I don't know why. I just know that at a certain point, Britain's obituaries got cheeky. And they decided, you know, this business of never speaking ill of the dead was passé, and you had to feel free to speak of the dead as
precisely.
They should be spoken of.
Yeah.
1985,
it was 1985.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know you could date it that precisely. But
there's also the matter that in American papers, the illusion, if not reality, of objective journalism, of fairness, says you're not supposed to have opinions about the person. We simply put forward the facts of the person's life. On the other hand, I do think it's true that this is more and more the case at the Times. I know that Bruce Weber, the angel of death, is somewhere in the room. I don't know whether Biff Grimes also... Oh, there he is. And what I think that they've both been demonstrating in the Times is that it's an opportunity to be a writer. The way that most people are covering straight news don't have the opportunity. And so that even though it may not be filled with the cheekiness and the insult, I get a sense of what these people think about the person they're writing about because they're very good at it.
Your book was going to be called A Sparrow Flight. Why?
Yes.
Oh, well, it's a marvelous story.
Yes, this goes back to the story in The Venerable Bede about a sparrow flying through a banqueting hall, flying out of the dark through a lighted hall and then flying out of another window, and this was a metaphor for human life. And I've often played around with this image because I think the sparrow hasn't necessarily come in from the dark. The sparrow's possibly come in from the light and then gone to a murkier existence and then gone out and finds the light again. I mean, that's my personal philosophy at any rate. And what is there in this dark hall or this place the sparrow flies through just for a brief moment, I always feel there's some moment in that hall where the sparrow kind of realizes what it's there for, and that in every life there's a moment when the subject realizes what it's going to bring to the scene. And in I think most of the obits I've done, I've found some little incident in the life or some theme that seems to illuminate the whole progression through earthly existence. There's a moment, for example, Karlheinz Stockhausen, the composer, when I did his obituary, I found out that when he was a child, he used to carry a little hammer around in his pocket all the time, and he'd knock things, and he'd love hearing the reverberation they made. And that went through all those years.
Or Luciano Pavarotti,
have
the same.
Yes, Pavarotti the same, that there was a moment when he just suddenly jumped on the kitchen table and sang. He was about 6 years old. And it's a wonderful scene because his family all applauded him wildly for doing this. And in that moment, you could feel that he had decided, right, performing is my life from now on.
I'm trying to imagine Pavarotti doing that at 60.
Yes, unfortunate for the table.
Terrifying.
Yeah, trying to imagine that particular table.
Yeah. The obit would have been for the table. Exactly.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Well, you know, I was very struck by that comment that comes again and again about the key, the moment you look for, and I want to address everybody on this very issue. Carlo, the great historian Carlo Ginzburg, talks about the crucial moments in one's life, and this is what he says. I'm skeptical about the teleological approach that sees sort of a straight line going from the childhood of an individual to his or her maturity. I may not be able to recognize the crucial elements in my life, so I'm not the best judge. If I think about my life and about my choices as a historian, the question I put to myself, or in fact to anybody else, is which choices were the crucial ones? And so the question then becomes, is the obituary writer the person who in some way susses out, is able to discover, to imagine, to see what was hidden for the life when lived.
Gosh, I think that would be too presumptuous to say that's what we do, but what I'd like to fix on is your idea of the straight line. I think it's interesting that if you would take a life from birth to death and just follow it straight through in chronological order, which some obituaries still do, I think that is not the way to capture a life at all. I think you do have to home in on certain points in it. There'll be one or two incidents that will really illuminate the whole thing. I think it was Virginia Woolf who said that it might be possible to write a whole life out of one tiny incident, maybe even just 2 minutes. And I think that might be true. There is going to be some moment in a life that will suddenly make sense of the whole thing. And you could extrapolate from that to bring in other elements in the life. I mean, I feel it's important to get away from chronology.
Get away from chronology, Marilyn?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. The dreadful chronology, which drags down the marching facts, which weigh down so many obituaries. And they're an important part of it. They're an important part of it, not only for the people's family, for the genealogical people who follow, and for the historic record, but in terms of a read, in terms of a narrative, they really get in the way. And there are some newspapers that have figured out how to...
The life gets in the way, but
the facts,
the facts
of the life,
get in
the
way.
Train. Yes,
the all facts are not the life.
The awards, the years that they graduated from this place or that place. Those are things that you have to get through in order to get to the stories and get the sense of the breathing, living person. And that's what you're trying to do. You're really trying to bring someone back to life. And if you don't get that sense when you finish an obituary of, I know what the essence of that person was, if it's not breathing, then it has failed in some sense.
I'm going to make a case for chronology. I wasn't intending to set me up. Two cases. The first, I find that the lives of the people that we know on the public stage, we no longer know them when they step off the public stage. I think this is particularly true of athletes and entertainers. You know the athlete from the time that he or she is 20 to 40, perhaps, the entertainer to 50 to 60. Well, what did Ginger Rogers do in the remaining 30 years of her life? And learning that is really a reward. The public life we might know, but we don't know the life that comes after it. And then there are those lives that take these turns and where chronology suits them. And I won't read this entire obituary, it's, I think, a model. It was written by Bob McFadden, the great rewrite man at the Times, about a man named Amory Bradford, who happened to be the general manager of the Times. He worked at the Times for many years. I will skip through and then get to the key point. With that name, he was the direct descendant of the second governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. He was Andover, Yale Law School, Army Intelligence. Then he went to work at the Times, and he was picked by the Times, by the newspaper publishers, to be their spokesman and their negotiator during the great newspaper strike that I was speaking about before. And it talks about how, to get a sense of him, the Publishers Association chose Mr. Bradford as its point man in negotiations with Typographical Union No. 6 and its president, Bertram A. Powers. They were natural enemies from the start. Mr. Powers, a high school dropout, was a tough, relentless negotiator, the embodiment of a gut fighter up from the streets. Mr. Bradford, an Ivy League aristocrat, impeccably dressed and 6 feet 4 inches tall, was accustomed to snapping orders at pliant subordinates. One top-level mediator said Mr. Bradford brought an attitude of such icy disdain into the conference rooms that the mediator often felt he ought to ask the hotel to send up more heat. His career crashes after that at the Times, and he leaves, and he's a consultant to the Ford Foundation. He's an executive at the Scripps Howard newspapers. He has a job at the Commerce Department. He's one of the people in the early years of the Nixon administration who set up the Environmental Protection Agency. And then we learn, in later years, Mr. Bradford acknowledged having become a jobless alcoholic, but he began psychiatric treatment, quit drinking, and radically changed his lifestyle. He began studying massage and psychotherapy at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. Wait. The last time he attended a reunion in the Thousand Islands with his fellow Yale Skull and Bones members, one remembered Amory lounging in the nude while they sat on the beach in their trunks. In fact, he went nude for most of the day. From 1978 to 1982, Mr. Bradford lived in a van, traveling in the United States, Canada, and Mexico, occasionally revisiting Esalen. He practiced Gestalt therapy, and he and his wife, Lorene, also taught massage. In recent years, he had been writing his memoirs. In a statement he composed for his own obituary, he said that his, quote, final years were intensified by the practice of Siddha Yoga meditation taught by Swami Muktananda, to whom he had been introduced by his daughter. This so easily could have been a very perfunctory, here's what he did in his public life. And then that's so, what we mostly get. But going into the part of the private life that wasn't on stage is what makes it safe.
So why is it modeled for you?
Well, because of that, it takes me beyond what I might already know. Now, I mean, obviously, when I read the great obits of, you know, there was the, McGee, the man who invented kitty litter, one of the great obits. I never knew that anyone ever invented kitty litter. I thought, you know,
several did actually.
I thought it evolved, and so I knew nothing about this man. So it was great to read that. But when I'm reading about a public figure, even a public figure whose public life may be as small as Amory Bradford's, it's what I don't know. What is that aspect of personality and character and experience that we did not experience when he was on the front pages of the newspaper?
Yeah, I agree with that. It's a good point. I know I was very thrilled to find out when I was doing Arthur Miller's obituary, and this was one that caused me great pain because I had to do so much reading in such a short time. But I found out also that he was very fond of carpentry. When he wasn't writing plays, he was being a carpenter. And he was building rooms, houses, all sorts of things. But to my mind, that was the key, actually, to him, was rather than the writing of plays, was the
carpentry.
Construction. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was because his plays are so wonderfully constructed. This is what strikes me about them. And when you know that this is also a man who sort of fits joints together and looks at how, you know, wood fits at an angle into this and that and what will support what, it throws a whole new light on the playwriting. So I was quite keen to spend at least a paragraph on the carpentry.
But also what you read strikes me as very significant and important, and Marilyn, you talk about this in your book, is the importance of humor. The importance of humor in the obituaries.
Well, The death is dispensed with in a phrase or a sentence. It really is not a huge part. It's the occasion of the obituary, but it's not the content of the obituary, the substance of it. Except I will say that I read a lovely obit the other day in which a woman's long decline in the hospital room was called her last salon.
Oh. Mm.
It was very nice. But for the most part, we do not deal with the death, and very little with the decline. The rest of it is life. The rest of it is humor. The rest of it is, you know, whatever makes up that life. Sometimes it's tragedy, but it is so wonderful to be surprised on the obits page, and that is a page where you are frequently surprised. You know the ending. It's always bad ending, bad ending, bad ending. And yet, there is so much. I know people who read the obits page, and whether they actually have a belly laugh or not, they put the page down and say, I feel alive now.
Sure. It's not necessarily a bad ending.
No.
We don't know the ending.
No. Actually, you deal with the ending nearly not at all, I noticed. I mean,
That's right.
You sometimes don't... I mean, it's a bad ending. Best line I remember about that comes from my mother. I was using talcum powder one day, and my mother said to me, you know, talcum powder is very bad for you, Paulie. You really shouldn't use it. I said, really? Why? She said, well, you know, you breathe. And then she looked at me and she realized that this was perhaps an overstatement. And she said, you know, Paul, living is dangerous and the outcome is always fatal. So, I mean, you know, it is true. I mean, but you, in your obituaries, what I noticed is that, unlike the Times obituaries or other papers, you seldom mention how people died or what caused them to pass into
to
the
only,
next world.
Only if it's something extraordinary or, you know, some sudden death, someone too young.
Do you consider it not important?
Not important at all. No.
It's British. It's that's the British bias. No, the British, they're disgusted when we put the details in the obits. This is, no, I've heard
I don't
this.
Think it's disgusting. I just really don't think it's important. When you only have 1,000 words,
so you don't, think
you don't
it's
want
British,
to spend it on.
Particularly.
Not particularly. I think it might be me. I mean, we do get letters saying, why do you never say what people die of?
And it was striking.
They're all from America. Yeah.
They are all from America, as it happens.
This was an issue in my job as public editor, where people came to complain to me and about everything. but you're invading privacy to say why the person died. And then the contrary one, this was, of course, a much bigger issue in the 80s and the early 90s when people died of whatever euphemism was for AIDS. That it was reported it was pneumonia, it was complications of cancer, and there was quite a bit of controversy in the journalism racket about, well, we're not telling the truth here if we know something else. When does that private portion of a person's life, does it stay private after the person dies, if he or she does not want it there? Susan Sontag died when I was at the Times, and very, very controversial because there was no mention of her survivors, and she was believed to be, and many people insisted so, to have been in a long-term relationship with a woman, a well-known woman, but the family wouldn't confirm it. So is that the Times' job to tell you or not? People were offended that they did not.
Yes, and Marilyn, you were talking earlier about people's drinking problems and whether these were ever owned up to in obituaries.
And suicide is a problem, too. I've read obits that said, we took her to treatment. We kept taking her to treatment, and it just never took.
Obviously.
And that's, it's fascinating to read that in an obit because it's real, as opposed to, convivial and always had the door open. which they could have said for the very same person.
Could we ask the guys who do this for a living Bruce or Beth, do you want to talk about what's the Times' policy on, or your personal policy on?
As far as I know, there is no policy. I think of it as part of the news reporting, mitigated by the fact that if the family is going to feel uneasy, they're in a bad enough state.
I think. There is no policy at the Times. I think it's almost always a question of if we can find out, we print it. If it is important to the, if the cause of death is somehow pertinent to the life, we'll make a greater effort. If there is some reason that the family doesn't want to tell me how the person died, what am I supposed to do? Reach over the phone and threaten them with their own death? I mean, it's not there isn't much I can do. I always ask, and sometimes you can tell that they're kind of formulating the cause of death on the other end of the line. But there really isn't much you can do. You ask, and if you get the information, you report it.
The French philosopher Blaise Pascal once said that no one dies so poor that he does not leave something behind. Mm-hmm. And I feel that your obituaries, the ones you've chosen to the people you've selected for the pages of The Economist, illustrate this quite well. Whether it is Martin Teitel to some extent, but also the man who invented not, what was it?
Kitty litter.
Kitty litter.
I love the way you say that.
Well, whenever you'd like me to say it.
Please.
Kitty litter.
The guy. the fellow in Philadelphia who writes the obituaries.
Jim Nicholson.
This I think is a great. Why don't you talk about him a bit?
Talk about him. I'll come back to noodles after.
Oh,
that.
Noodles. Yeah.
Noodles. But talk about Philadelphia before talking about noodles. Mm.
Well, a very interesting thing happened in the 80s in Philadelphia when the Daily News, Philadelphia Daily News decided they would start doing obituaries. Now, the Philadelphia Inquirer had been doing obituaries for quite some time, and they did a great job sending off the former mayors and the various celebrities. They decided, since they were the people's paper, that they were going to write obituaries of ordinary people. And they got a man, Jim Nicholson, who had been a tremendous investigative reporter and had been a bit down on his luck lately. And he decided, yes, indeed, this was a task that he would take on. He began by writing these long obits of people like a grandmother who had never held a job in her life and whose hobbies were playing poker and eating cereal. He would do a long obit about a plumber and include in it several...
Not Joe.
But he made it interesting. He approached it as an investigative reporter. He asked hundreds of questions, interviewed multiple people, and wrote it up like it was the most incredible drama. So you would finish reading this obit of a plumber, and you would know how to unclog your toilet. You would know something about the hopes and dreams of this person, and you would have a real sense of them, almost more as a character in a short story than as, you know, an ordinary newspaper reader. And in fact, that's what he talked about. He did this for 19 years, and he said, "I felt like I was burying the newspaper readers." Thank you, Paul.
I think that's absolutely fantastic. I would love to write obits like that of ordinary people. And the closest I can get to it is when someone suddenly dies who remembers some particular world, and they're only remembered, really, they're famous because they've survived.
Well, you write about that. I mean,
when I do.
Well, you do. I mean, for instance, one of the most moving obituaries in this book is an obituary about Mary Smith. Maybe you could say something about her, because I think... Yeah. It's a haunting obituary, and it pays with you say at one moment that you're particularly taken by paying tribute to the last witness.
Yes.
And in this particular case, she was witness to what?
Well, she was the last speaker of the Ayak language in Alaska, one of the Inuit languages, and the reason I was fascinated by her was simply that a language is a world, and if you lose a language, every language you lose a worldview, a particular way of looking at things. And so I wanted to find out about this language, really. I looked everywhere. It's almost impossible to find out anything about it, but I used every word I could find of the language. For example, there were 30 or 40 different words for different bits of the spruce tree. And I thought no other person would have looked at a spruce tree quite like that. So I wanted to paint the whole landscape in as many words of this language as I could find.
And in that way, there is a connection because a plumber is one form, but you were in some way smuggling into that obituary words. In some way, the obituary there was a form of saving. Saving the language from oblivion,
in the thousand words
you had. Yeah.
Try and understand it. Mm-hmm. The person who didn't thank me for doing that was the woman who reads The Audio Economist, when she found these completely incomprehensible, unpronounceable words all full of glottal stops and things. And she had no idea how to proceed at all. But that was something I really did enjoy doing. Another one that I loved was The Last Cavalryman on the Western Front, which to me was extraordinary. I mean, this was the last man who rode into battle, as people had ridden into battle since Xenophon's day, on horseback, kind of right into the guns. And it was amazing to me, this ordinary man who'd signed up when he was too young, because I find often, I've done two or three Great War survivors now, all of them joined up too young. Mm-hmm. And that makes me feel such an extraordinary sort of sadness for these people. We know what a ghastly war that was, but for them it was release from a humdrum job of some sort or other. They couldn't wait to get there. And we found photographs of them to illustrate the obituaries, smiling, you know, as they sign up. And you, of course, they live to tell the tale, but somehow their spokesman, their eyes that remain from that whole generation, I find that very moving.
Let's not forget Noodles.
Oh, Noodles. Yes.
Because that's a very interesting, common...
common thing.
The noodle man, yes, a Japanese inventor of the dried, the pot noodle. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what I was thinking.
That was good fun to
litter
do.
Litter kitty, because it's also...
Litter kitty.
because it's also very... You wouldn't think that this had That's been right. invented, but mm-hmm. the way yep. you tell that story and that mm-hmm. that man's disappointment yes, was, up to that moment.
It mm-hmm. was very difficult to create pot noodle, apparently. You know, he went through many, many experiments. I mean, it's now such disgusting stuff, but it went through many iterations. And almost more than the noodle man, I loved the man who had to invent, the first man who invented non-dairy frozen topping. And I really wrote that obituary just because there was the greatest photograph in the world of this man. There were five of them, all with kind of 1950s slick back hair in suits, all standing around this bowl of frozen dairy topping with this gloop coming off a spoon. I love that photograph so much. But this is all human endeavor. You know, I love the amount of time it takes people to make the perfect noodle or the perfect topping and the number of failures they have and they keep going. I mean, this is better for me than a great general or a great politician.
Oh, this is a better history of our times yeah, than it is. Almost anything you can think of.
The politicians are dull much of the time.
Russell Baker once wrote in his column on the editorial page, he did really an obit for an actor, I think his name was Jack Liu. He was Chinese-American, but was coming into his prime as an actor in the right age during and after World War II, and he played dying Japanese. He was committing harakiri, or he was flying a kamikaze plane, or he was getting... And he died in 40 films.
Oh, that's great.
That's a life.
Oh, what that's a great life. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's wonderful.
Let's talk a little bit about timing and the different ways in which, and obviously we can turn to some of the colleagues in your field to compare and contrast what they do to what you do and to what you have researched in your book so well. I was interested to read that the morgue, as it is referred to at The Economist, is rather empty.
Yes.
You only have 7 or 8 dead people waiting to die.
Yes, that's true. By comparison, the Daily Telegraph, which is a provider of marvelous obits in Britain, has 800 on the stocks, and I'm sure the Times must have 1,000.
1,500.
1,300.
We have 7, and one is Saddam Hussein, who's somewhere. He's still there for some reason.
So you really have to write
him on
the deadline.
I think we were taken by surprise.
Marilyn and I worked together in the early and middle 90s. I was the editor of Life magazine, and Marilyn wrote these tributes. And at Life, we specialize in death. We always had 4 or 5 special issues ready to go of well-known and ideally beloved figures who had entered the zone, as we called it, so that when they died, we would be able to, you know, say, run the presses. One of them, and as the editor, it was my job to pick who they were. One I inherited was Bob Hope. And then Bob Hope kept living.
Yeah, they always keep living. The morgue is a place you survive.
His fans had all died by the time that he died, so he never got his special issue.
He was a skeleton.
But you try to get ready in advance.
Yeah. But if we go back to this notion of what it means for you to write without that resource, you must approach your subject quite differently without the backing of so many possibilities from which you could easily choose. You in some way, your choices are perhaps made differently.
They might be. I mean, you're flying by the seat of the pants a bit.
What does that mean in this case?
Oh. Well, I'd like to decide on an obit the Friday before, but as it turns out, it's not until Monday morning that I can really confirm who I'm doing. So then there's a sort of frantic day and a half of actually...
Is that all the time you usually have?
Yes.
And so take us through how you get about doing a couple of obituaries in recent time. How did you go about, for instance, writing about, for instance, Martin Title?
Because you hadn't met him. No, I hadn't. No, I think I simply saw that
I probably spotted it in the Times, first of all, the New York Times, and thought, gosh, he sounds great. And then the thought will always go through my mind, gosh, but if the New York Times has done it and this is a New Yorker, mm-hmm. is there any point in The Economist now doing it? Can I do anything better than this? And I often think, no, I can't, and I won't do them.
So there's a competition between
the various... There's a feeling of competition, yes, definitely. I mean, it's the same with the Daily Telegraph in Britain, which specializes in colonels and old army types. And also in decadent aristocrats. It has this fantastic line in really wild, eccentric people who go and live in the Bahamas and bathe in champagne. And I mean, you simply cannot beat the Telegraph at some of those things. And I just admire them, and I decide I can't go there. But... otherwise, gradually I start to think about the character, and I'll go and read as much as possible of what they've written about themselves or interviews they've given, because what I most want to do in an obituary is get inside the head of the character and try and see the world as they saw it, and if I can, try to almost use their language and look through their eyes, even though it's not always a very pleasant experience. I think it's important to have that empathy. Because we may not be running appreciations, we're not, but I feel also there's got to be a slight understanding of what this person thought they were doing when they were alive and what they thought they were bringing to the world, what good or bad they were aware of doing, and bringing that to readers. It's important.
It's a literary process.
Yes,
it is very much a literary process. Mm-hmm. And if you're on a very short deadline, if you're at a newspaper, and most of the people that I interviewed for my book are newspaper writers who they don't have the luxury of several days to think of them, and they're not thinking of them as a character. They have a couple of hours to pull together something that makes sense and breathes. If you have a little bit more time, which is what the kinds of obituary tributes that I was trying to do and that you do beautifully in 1,000 words, it is a literary endeavor, and you are really trying to bring a character to life and wrap it up in a literary way. Well, you are, yes. I think that's...
Yes, you are.
And yeah. I don't think it's an accident that you called him a character. Hmm. I mean, I really think that as many literary flourishes as you can use and as many skills as you have, all your chops, it's one of the things that weighs on you when you sit down to consider a life and try to make it come together. And that is, you have to use everything you know and all of your skills. It is not something you can really fake your way through.
I was interested, and we'll come back to the notion of getting into the character and getting into what one might call the voice. Mm. The sympathy you feel. What made you write about Alex the African Grey? Science best known parrot died on September 6, 2007, aged 31.
Well, this
I mean,
is
I did feel
I
for him.
Yes, you feel for the parrot. and many of you here will know the kind of famous Monty Python dead parrot sketch. And I think that kind of been entirely out of the picture. This wasn't my idea. This was the science editor at The Economist who came running upstairs and said, "Do you know this parrot's dead?" And it was wonderful. He wrote a very nice piece because this parrot had actually been taught various skills, and I think he'd been taught to count to 5 and was nearly counting to 7 when he died.
if only he had lived longer.
Yes, this is right. But I think, why not? Why not do non-human subjects sometimes, if they're important? Yeah. I was almost tempted to do a cat called Humphrey, who was famous in Britain. He was a Downing Street cat. Various prime ministers came and went from number 10 Downing Street, and the cat went with number 10, and saw many a prime minister come and go. And you know, I think his view of life would have been a fascinating one.
And why didn't you do him?
I don't remember why. It may have been I was on holiday. I know I was on holiday when London killed off the Route Master bus, the real proper double-decker bus, which Londoners still lament to this day, and I'd like to have done the Route Master. So I'm still thinking there may be some non-human subjects out there. Yeah. Did I answer your question? Yeah.
I want to go back to the notion of voice and
yes.
sympathy, because in a way what you're trying to do is a work of, to some extent, the work of a historian. What the great French historian Jules Michelet said, that the historian's role is to make the silences of history speak. Mm-hmm. And in some way, in writing some of your other books, the book on Shelley, for instance, there is a kindredness, one might say, between the work of the biographer and the work of the obituary writer. And I'm wondering where you see the bridge between those two functions.
Right, well, the bridge to my mind is simply trying to get inside the head, inside the mind of someone else. You really have to climb in there and try and see things as they were seen by, I mean, in the case of Shelley, in the latest biography, that really was quite a trip for about 4 years, trying to climb inside that head. But I would much rather try to make that effort to be in there. Exhausting as it was completely exhausting and punishing, because he had read so much and because he voyages spiritually. I mean, he goes to places I could not have imagined. And I just had to hang on for grim life with him. And sometimes I feel that too with the obituary characters. You have got to try and get into their worlds as far as you can, and that way the life will become your life just for that moment. I mean, it's a process of total immersion that you will, with luck, you'll manage to, as you say, bring the person alive through almost becoming them. Yes, it's sort of 2 days being somebody else. It's very intense.
And I think that there's a connection on the other side as well. The well-crafted obituary is a resource for a future biographer or for future historians. I'm writing a book about the 20s. I've been working on it for 4 years, set in the 20s. And to know people long dead who are not huge in the national life, who have not been the subject of biographies, the only place one can go is often obituaries. And, you know, one of the great difficulties about writing about particularly figures in New York from that period is that the Herald Tribune was much, much better at obituaries than the Times was. The Times is very straight, just, you know, the facts, the facts, the facts, the facts. Of course, all the Times is online, and the Herald Tribune, you have to open envelopes at NYU and they fall apart in your hands. But I think that the fine obituaries written today by people at the Times and people at the Economist and the Telegraph and the Globe and Mail in Toronto, which does a very good job, they're essential documents. They will be primary sources for future historians and biographers.
Marilyn, what constitutes a significant life?
Any life, I would say. I mean, seriously, I really...
I'd agree.
I challenge you to find someone too boring to write a great obit of.
I think that's absolutely right. It's true.
Are you feeling worried?
Yeah. Well, no. I just thought about what that might entail. But I'm totally with. I mean, I'm fascinated by the celebrity obituaries that I read. I'm fascinated by. I mean, really, politicians can be very boring, but if you read the politicians in the Globe and Mail, they're fascinating. I would think business people would be terrifically boring, but the business obits that I read in the Wall Street Journal are fascinating.
But you also have said that you felt you needed to move away from the world of celebrity obits.
They
ended up...
I'll tell you what
found
I didn't
them
like.
Tedious. I mean,
no.
You know, the notion of fame, I mean, I'm always reminded of that line of Rilke, who said that fame is a sum of misunderstandings that gather around a new name. And so some way you wanted to get away from that world, no?
I definitely wanted to get it. Well, I hate interviewing celebrities. I just hate them.
You just hate them.
they say very nice things about you.
It's very difficult to actually get intimate with someone who is a celebrity anymore and be able to write something that's real. You're writing something that has been so rehearsed. You're getting such little access as a writer. It's not very fun to write. And it's been done over and over. You know, how many things have you read about Madonna? And it's hard to find something new to say. I loved, on the other hand, writing celebrity obituaries. I loved sending them off. It seemed like there was, you know, that was a competition that mattered, being able to imagine the 20th century without Princess Diana. That was, you know, and everybody in the world, in fact, I'm sure many of you in this room, wrote Princess Diana tributes. It seemed like everyone was. And so you're forced to think of something different to say. What I do not like are the obits that have been sitting in the morgue for many years, you know, getting dusty and gray and sitting there. They're so considered, they're so fraught, they're so weighted, and they don't have any of that juice. Mm-hmm. That something that's written on deadline by somebody who's in a bit of a panic.
It's true. That gives them their buzz. Yeah. It does. But I just wanted to add to what Marilyn said about celebrity. They may be very unsatisfying lives somehow to have to do, but behind the celebrity, often there's another story, which is really fascinating to try and find. I wrote the obituary of Anna Nicole Smith in The Economist. And there was someone being a celebrity, if you like. But
she
also,
what
a,
as much as Paul did.
Yes. Yes.
But also, here was a really sad story of someone. She was just a short order waitress in Texas, I think. And she wanted to be like Marilyn Monroe, and she was just never going to be like Marilyn Monroe. And it was such a story of failed longing to be a celebrity that I felt I simply had to do her. And in fact, she was suggested to me by people at the New York office who were in love with her and her huge pneumatic personality.
I don't know if you understood what I was saying, but you talk about her breasts with gusto.
I do because
her hands.
I felt yes, I thought I had to. In fact, I had a couple of paragraphs about them in the obituary where I put breasts uppercase, you know, capital letter for breasts, because they were such an important part of her. But I've but there you are. It was entertaining, and it was kind of wild young men who had suggested I've got to write about her. But on the other hand, what a sad story when I got inside it. So that part of it was kind of enjoying it in the best sort of end of the pier way, and then again feeling a great sort of sadness about the life. So that was one that was a nice balance to have to do.
Coming from an entirely different direction on the question of the significant life, one of the things that I'm sure happens to everybody who has ever worked at the Times for more than a day is that for the rest of one's life, you are called by people who say, my doctor's cousin's brother's nephew died last week, and the family wants an obituary in the Times more than anything. It confirms the life. What can you do to get it in? Unlike The Economist, where there's one a week, the Times there's an accordion of space there. And it was the case certainly when I was working at the paper, but it has continued. I get calls like this at least once a month that I would know somebody who would make it possible. And there's a wonderful euphemistic way of saying no that I've heard many people at the Times use. I'm quite certain it's not policy, but it's an easy way to say no, which is to say if the person was never in the paper when he or she was alive, they're not going to get in the paper when they're dead. Now, I don't think that was true about Mr. Kitty Litter, in fact, but they, it's obviously wrenching, any death to the loved ones, to the survivors, but this longing for the certification of an obit in the Times for people who live in Greater New York particularly is extraordinary and deep and abiding. And I believe that there's been, to the Times' financial benefit, at a time that the Times needs financial benefit, there's been a corollary to this in the paid death notices, mm-hmm. in the lengthier and lengthier paid death notices,
which have changed.
Mm-hmm. And if you read them, they are now usually very poor facsimiles of newspaper obituaries. But there's clearly the effort that this is what we have to preserve the life and to mm-hmm. confirm the life.
Since we're in a building that mattered greatly to her, you also did an obituary of Brooke Astor.
Yes.
But you felt that she was not enough for that single obituary.
Well, no, there was a very happy chance for an obituary writer that Brooke Astor and Leona Helmsley died more or less in the same week, because they were such a fantastic contrast with each other. I mean, I don't have to tell any New Yorkers how they were different. And Brooke Astor is such a sort of wonderfully aristocratic figure, full of manners and breeding and in every way the sort of perfect philanthropist. And Leona Helmsley, this rather loud-mouthed, nasty... I'm trying not to say rhymes with rich here. Mm. But with her snappy little dog that she carried around in her purse and this kind of thing. And to put those two side by side was great. So that was a double header that I did with the two of them. And it was just marvelous to kind of pile on these delicate adjectives with Brooke Astor, and I was comparing her to mice in China and all sorts of things. Then you could paint the picture of Leona Helmsley as a sort of tart figure. That was really fun to do. And yet I felt at the end that both of them had been sort of... they'd both been generous to New York. In the end, I felt like being kinder to Leona, because she had had a bad deal, in a sense, from the press. Everyone was laying into her, and she was very much the sinner to Brooke Astor's saint. And yet, when you looked in terms of how many hospitals she'd supported and so on, you know, they were equal helpers of New York. So I tried to end on a note of making them more or less equivalent. Yeah. But it was enormous fun, that one.
Though the last line, if I remember it well, ends by saying that one was a saint and one was a sinner. Mm. More or less.
Yes.
When you go out in the morning and pick up your New York Times, you look at the page of the obituaries. What are you looking for, and what delights you in reading those pages?
Well, it's changed over the years. I think that when I began reading, it was learning about people and people's lives. Now I'm figuring out the average age of the people who died.
Yes.
The last 2 days have been great. 99, 95, 90, and 99. It's an average of 96.3, which is, I feel, fabulous. And now it's getting to the point of where how many were younger than I am. You know, so. I look for two things, actually. First, what is the lead obituary? And I'm going to read it no matter who it is. And then, obviously, people I know about and know something about. But one of the other things I love to do on that page, I do look through the death notices to see if I can find the person that should be an obituary that they haven't found yet and that they'll get to 2 days later. It happens pretty frequently. And I guess that they have to scout it as well. It's an unhealthy obsession, but it's rewarding to me.
Marilyn, unhealthy obsession?
I think it's a perfectly healthy one, how could I say to this room of people it was an unhealthy obsession?
You can.
We're
you
all
can just
in
say
this
it's
together. It's not
obsession.
The door has been locked and we must all own up to it. No, I think it's. I think we care about life, and I think we care about, and we care about being surprised. I mean, it's the same news over and over again. Really, it's very hard to get surprised on the front page, on the front section, in the Metro section. I would say 8 days out of 10, you can find a nugget on the obituary page that will carry you through half a dinner party. I mean, there's like all kinds of crazy things. we think life is these simple dinner boy
they
meets
die
girl.
For our dinner parties.
the incredible instincts of the people who work on that desk at the Times and at some of the other fine obit pages for the telling detail, for the amazing anecdote, for you know the story of you know an escape from Russia that you've never heard before, or you know I mean you never know what you're going to read on the obits page. It's the fantastic thing about it.
One of the striking of the Times that the paper goes up online, I think at 10 o'clock the night before, but the obits do not. They make you wait until morning for them. I was talking with Bruce about that before, and he said it has to do with systems. And I think that there's something more diabolical.
Yes. No. Tony yeah. Hillerman went up. But he at went up
today.
5 o'clock.
I noticed Tony Hillerman went up, and I was coming here, and my God,
Tony Hillerman,
the world has changed. There's a withholding. Because there's this, I think, the surprise value that Marilyn is talking about, something you didn't know. You're not going to find it online cruising around to various sites. You're going to open the Times in the morning, and you will find out about a person you have never heard of before.
How did you become the Economist's undertaker?
I think I put my name down for it. I realized this was a lovely position to hold, and when my predecessor, Keith Cahoon, would go on a holiday, I would do the obituaries, and I thought, this is the best thing I've ever done on the paper. I mean, I've been literary editor and US editor and so on, but having to write the obituaries, I could write as I liked, and there's not many places on a paper where you can do that normally. I just went into the editor and said, I'd like to do it when it next comes up, and
that was what happened. What has been your greatest joy writing an obituary?
Oh, I think it's that moment when you realize that you've hit the essence of the life, that you're able to kind of write a piece that will begin with some incident or some remark or some little thing that will then take you almost in a circular progression, and you'll come back to it at the end and you'll create something that's really satisfying. I always plot how they'll go as I'm walking home on Monday night. And Leicester Square seems to be the place that has the best vibe. You know, as I go through the square, usually something will click. And then I'll think how it's going to be, and it'll turn out that way.
Here I think it's the Port Authority bus terminal across.
Thank you very much. If we could bring up the lights in the room so that our distinguished guests can see you when you dare ask a question. And there are mics coming around.
When did you start to read them?
I started when I started reading the Times. I grew up in Detroit and started reading the Times when I was a freshman in college, and there they were. I don't think it became the first thing I turned into the newspaper until I was at least 22.
I did read obits occasionally before this, but in the mid-80s, on a Saturday in the New York Times, I've written about, I opened up, and the scientist who had isolated vitamin C and the scientist who had isolated vitamin K had somehow died within a day of each other, and they each had substantial, incredible obits. And so C and K, and I just thought, I don't know, I'm still like stunned by that. I'm still walking around saying, do you believe it? I mean, two guys connected with the Grateful Dead, one who was a keyboardist with Jerry Garcia, and their business manager and lawyer both passed away within a day of each. I mean, you know, these things happen all the time, but this one
John
really
and
converted
Thomas
me.
Jefferson.
There you go. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Now, I'm trying to remember when I first read them. I think I've only ever read them regularly since I became Obits editor. But I remember the Winston Churchill obit making a tremendous impression on me. And it was just so huge, his obit in the paper. And there was a fabulous photograph, which you still see sometimes, of, was it Winston Churchill's? I can't quite remember whether it was his or whether it's King George VI now. I'm just thinking of this picture of the three queens in mourning. It was a fabulous picture of the queens with their long black dresses and their black veils.
It's George VI.
It was George VI, not Churchill. Yeah. And that sort of drew me into the drama of public death, if you like, I suppose. But I still didn't read the obits page with any regularity until I began to feel that they were all competing with mine. And now I do.
Yes, I'm wondering if you feel that any obits in the last year or so have been really botched.
Botched.
Who's died?
Who's died?
Yes. Who's died?
Racking
Who's died?
Our brain.
Well, with the two lead obit writers and the paper I read here in the room, I don't think I can answer that question.
Do you ever think about your own obituaries and how they'll be written? And do you have any hopes you'd be willing to share about how they'd be written? Or?
It's a no-brainer. Come on. I mean, you know.
I must say the only thing I hope is that people don't go through it from, you know, go through my life from birth to death. And in fact, it was that feeling very strongly that I hope nobody would ever write my life from birth to death that's made me kind of junk chronology in my books and in my obits. I began to think it's just not the way if people want to know about me, that's not the way they're going to find me. I'm going to wriggle away from that. Because I think the soul, I mean, I'm very much a believer in the soul, and the soul gets away from any attempt to confine it. And you've got to try and pin it down some other way. And so I think everyone who dies, everyone who lives, is setting a challenge to everybody else who wants to comment on that life. You've got the most elusive thing in the world there that you've got to try and grab hold of. So, yeah, I hope someone can do mine, but who knows, maybe not.
I'm not going to be here, and I really don't care, but I, you know, I just think it's, how can you resist? I mean, somebody who writes about obituaries is well, first of all, tempting fate. You know, I mean, I really, and I said when the book first came out, I said to my publicist, if something happens to me, run with it. You know, it's like, you know, it's just...
I think about it constantly. All I really care is that it's above the fold.
Questions for Anne. Maybe it's another way of asking the botched question. Have you ever received a piece of criticism about an obituary that made you think you'd got it wrong?
Let me see. I don't know that I have.
Anna Nicole was not very popular.
Anna Nicole was not a popular one at all. No, that's true. But that was because people imagined that The Economist should only write obituaries of people who are noble and worthy.
It was a choice of subject.
Right. They were shocked by that, I think. The Indian Bandit, yes. same reason. They didn't like the idea that we should cover a bandit. And I did I did a very nasty segregationist sheriff from Selma, Alabama. And because I was trying to see the world through his eyes, you know, it's read like a pretty racist obit in the end, because I wanted to give the voice of somebody. I think, thank God, that people who are that deeply steeped in segregationism have gone. You know, he is he is a representative or was of a world that's going. And so I wanted to bring his voice out. And it was not a nice voice to hear, to be honest.
And that was a voice you were happy to bring to rest in some way.
Yes, but it was also important to hear it.
Whilst I imagine that there's some obits you write where you would want to continue writing the piece and keeping the voice alive in some way.
Yes, but then...
I mean, the notion of regret, I think, must come to bear in your work at times.
Yes, it does, with a feeling if a life seems to have been a bit wasted or, you know, hasn't been satisfactory to the person themselves. I don't know whether it's... I mean, I believe very strongly that the spirit continues, and therefore I can't feel that this is the end. And as I write it, you know, the regret is more sometimes that people have made a real mess of having been through Earth, if you like.
The sparrow's flight.
The sparrow's flight, yes. And that's a shame. But wanting to continue the voice, I think it does continue, whether I want it to or not.
You write, I see my obituaries as progress reports on a life that continues somewhere elsewhere.
Somehow
yeah. Elsewhere.
Yeah, I think so. We don't know how, but I just believe that life is a continuum and never, you know, life does not end ever.
So. Jobs, and it is a job. Mm. And I've listened to how you create your job. And I'm interested in how you distance yourself from it, or after you finish the piece that will be printed for the world to read, do you have a time where you are in mourning or you have grief because you've personalized it, because you've been in touch with this person so intimately by doing this research to be able to tell about their life?
I don't feel any grief, but maybe that is only because I have to get on with the next part of my work normally because, you know, I do edit other things on The Economist. So as soon as I finish the obit, I'm on to the next lot of work that's piled on the desk. And so there's not much time to... I don't think of them essentially as sad things. I mean, Marilyn was making the same point there. They're celebrations of life, they're bringing to life rather than the reverse. So if it's gone well, I feel, you know, a great satisfaction, having a great joy to have been with that person. Or sometimes it's true, rather a disgust at having been with that person if they're not pleasant. But not regret, no. I feel the same sort of satisfaction as when you finish a poem or something, because it is, again, as Marilyn said, it's a literary enterprise. And to my mind, it's got to end on the right note, and it's got to work as music also. I mean, writing to me has to be musical, and therefore it has to be constructed almost like some piece of music and end in that satisfactory way, if it's gone well.
Have you ever come across family members who have, after reading an obituary that you have written, felt as though they knew someone of their family better than before the obituary? Have you ever gotten comments of that sort?
Well, there have been one or two, but not better than. But I mean, I
because that moment of
illumination.
But because of that moment of illumination that you're looking for, is so rarely something that one finds during the lifetime. It seems as the owl of Minerva takes its flight at dusk. Afterwards, retrospectively, one can see it.
Well, I don't think I could do them as well as that, you know, to surprise members of the family. I'm just very gratified sometimes that members of the family call me or say, you know, they'd really enjoyed it. And I think it amazes me when they say that, because I haven't known the person. I mean, not in life, not personally. So it's a very great compliment if that happens. I'm very grateful to them.
I was the complaint department, so people would not come to me because the shirt fits, so they come because it doesn't. And it was one thing that was fairly common, not with the extremely well-known people, but people who merited space in the Times, the family feeling not, well, partly, but you left out XYZ, how could that's those are the important things, but including anything negative. You know, if the person had a distinguished life but spent a year in jail somewhere along the way, that ought to be in the obit, but the family doesn't want it there.
Yeah.
And there's the notion of the insult of this permanent memorial, bringing up that which we wouldn't bring up at the memorial service itself, at the funeral, seems to be something fairly common. The guys who write them would know better than I, but I heard that quite frequently when I was at the paper.
It brings up the notion of what do we owe the dead.
Right. Or well, it's the conflict between what do we owe the dead and what do we owe the reader. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I think most people in this business land on the latter one.
Yeah.
Good evening. I just want to tell you that I'm the non-descendant of my step-grandmother who lived to 108. Mayor Bloomberg threw her a party, and 3 months later she was gone. But I think the secret to her longevity was olive oil. My question this evening is really to the gentleman from the New York Times, which I believe is over my right shoulder. And I keep on seeing Stuart Mott's picture in the blog section of the obituaries. And I'm wondering why it is that he's so prevalent at this stage, and I think it's been 3 months now since he's passed away.
I think it's simply because the next person for whom we have a video tribute has not yet died.
Art Buchwald was there for forever.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, we are continuing to try to do these video tributes. They're a little bit tricky, as you might imagine. Some people, when you suggest to them that they might want to speak for posterity in front of the camera, they think you're crazy. So, I mean, we get a lot of different reactions to these suggestions. But and so the store of the video tributes is relatively small, and that the ones that we have, they're still alive. So.
You'd be willing to do one of those, right?
Call me.
Yeah, go ahead.
This raises another question with me, though. I've heard that there's a growing trend for people to write their own obituaries and make sure that the paper runs their own obituaries. Do you get that much on the Times?
It doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen.
I mean, they ask. I'm sure they must ask, but it's...
The letter goes unanswered.
They used to send them to me. I'm surprised. Maybe they just somebody's intercepting them. But in fact, I still what I was referring to before about the people who, because I once worked there, therefore I can help them get the obit in. They say, "Well, we've already written it. Could you send that on to the Times?" I'm very, very common in my life.
Well, I mean that sort of thing does happen. But they say we've already written the obit, and I say, "Well, sure. Let us see it." And then we read it and write our own, but it's
absolutely.
And a question here?
Because you're speaking of literary enterprise, and clearly the obit is a genre, but what genre is it closest to? I was so struck that you said a poem is clearly not a mini-biography. Biography implies time. Is it a mini-drama? What's the closest?
Short story.
Yeah, some teachers said fiction.
I think short story. short story, yes.
Well, journalism is at best a facsimile of a facsimile of a facsimile of what really happens in the world. So the writer and the editor making choices about the construction is inventing. I mean, not lying, but inventing. And so I think it is probably closest to finely wrought fiction.
I make a case that obits are their own literary form. And, you know, it takes several forms. The real person obituary, which is much more discursive, does not follow the structure that you read in the New York Times, is a distinct form from the newspaper obituary, from the tribute, which is what Anne does. But I think it's its own literary form. And... you know, I'm sorry that more courses aren't taught in it in journalism school.
I'd like to know how many
How many people are actually working in the morgue at the New York Times? And can we assume that at this very moment they're tinkering with the 1,400 lives?
Well, I think there's five full-time people who have the job of writing obituaries. Two of them are sitting right here next to each other. There's three others. The morgue is really just the library of clippings. And
but we should make a distinction between the way the word morgue is being thrown around here tonight is not the way we're used to hearing
take,
it. The,
take it easy.
I don't mean to get excited, but the subject is so dear to my heart. Yeah.
But it's that file of advance obits, or that library of advance obits that you're talking about, people aren't sitting there right now tinkering with them. They're sitting in a quiescent state, waiting to be tinkered with and updated. I wrote Studs Terkel's obit maybe 10 or 12 years ago. And clearly he's written, I don't know, 45 books
since
I wrote it. So some updating has to be done at some point. So, you know, they have to be brought up to date. You know, surviving relatives, and we always list, they've scattered, or maybe some of them have died, or they don't live in the places we said they live. So there's all that kind of stuff has to be adjusted at the last minute.
Don't you also often hear from other desks of the paper that this well-known figure in this field is very, very ill, maybe dying soon, and you yank it out?
Yeah. Mm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I hear Elizabeth Taylor is going to live forever.
We'll take a couple more.
Just to follow up on the morgue, you mentioned that The Economist, you only have six or seven people.
Yeah.
Would it be appropriate to ask who they are?
Now, can I remember? I know one of them is the King of Nepal. King of Nepal, Saddam Hussein, Nelson Mandela, Michael Foote, the Labour Party leader in Britain. Who are the others?
Keith Richards?
No. Well, it's completely random. It's totally random. It's because somebody...
Not the Queen.
No. And not Prince Philip, and he is not looking well at the moment. And I
you heard it here.
It's just completely random. It's that somebody sat down one day and thought, I think I'll write an obituary for somebody, just to put them in the stocks. And there are so many people we ought to do. But when I go to my colleagues and say, look, you know, we've really got to have, say, Teddy Kennedy, or, I mean...
Doesn't look any good.
Margaret Thatcher?
Well, we have got Margaret Thatcher, yes. Oh, okay. We have a huge production on her. But actually, I say to my colleagues, please, you know, will you just do me one? And they say, I mean, this has come up before this evening, that they can't do it because they won't know until it actually happens what the feel is like on the day that it happens. There'll be a certain buzz, there'll be a certain context, things will have happened, there'll be events that have to be factored in. So they actually refuse to do it until they're on absolute deadline. I can sympathize with that.
Does it help if somebody dies earlier in your issue week?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's
Monday, Tuesday. Yeah.
Tuesday's a good time to die.
I pray.
That's true.
I don't want anyone to die on Wednesday. Yeah. I mean, I have to keep the Grim Reaper at bay.
In the world of sports, don't win the championship on Tuesday because Sports Illustrated goes to press on Monday.
Mm-hmm. It's the same thing.
This has been so interesting, and I think my favorite part was about these tiny formative moments that can presage a life or illuminate a life. And I was wondering, and forgive me, it might not be the kind of question that you can consider while the bright lights are on you, but I didn't know if any of the four of you, including Paul, had an awareness of what such a moment would be for you.
The light is awfully bright.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you can.
One of my favorite obits from the Daily Telegraph ended with the line,
He detested ratatouille and pesto. Somehow, you know, it turned out, the editor told me, it was just one of the little facts that they had accumulated that was left over at the end, and they just stuck it at the end, but it gave everything this, like...
Yeah. Brilliant. That's brilliant. Yeah.
I mean, I can't top that.
None of us can top that.
I was just about to say something. We'll have one more question.
I'm crazy about ratatouille. Yeah.
Let's get the mic if we could. Just 1 second.
Thinking of the typewriter man, are there any people that you've sort of eyeballed that you think would be really interesting if they got close, you know?
No, I don't ever have candidates in advance that I'm thinking of. I mean, that would almost be the look of death, you know? You couldn't. I keep reading round the obituaries that other folks do, and they'll come forward, the ones that I really like. I must say, it does sort of ring a bell as soon as there's someone who's likely. One of the ones, actually, I most regret that I couldn't do was there was one man who'd invented some little light aircraft, which meant that he could soar among the eagles, and he was actually observing eagles from flying among them. And I thought this was the most wonderful one I could do, and it appeared in The Guardian in London. And then I looked at the little strap at the bottom, and he had died 5 weeks before. And so there was no way I could do him. But, you know, something like that, I know immediately that that's somebody I've got to do. But I couldn't, from the great sum of human experience, focus in on one or two. As I say, that would almost be the look of death. You know, you would feel you were singling out this person. You do feel a little like the Grim Reaper yourself. I mean, this is how your colleagues think of you, as death approaching.
Well, when Alden Whitman did it at the Times, and he did many, many advance interviews, and he almost made built a public persona on Here Comes the Angel of Death. And I was a young editor at Alfred A. Knopf at the time, and Alfred A. Knopf was still alive. And the day that Alden Whitman came to the office, everything stopped. And it was both a warning and an incredible compliment.
Yeah.
And I've always been intrigued by that comment that you all know of Mark Twain, who said, the reports of my deaths have been greatly exaggerated. Mm-hmm. There are also those premature obituaries that are filled, the literature of obituaries is filled with them.
Oh, well, we love it. I mean, and apparently there have been some people, some subjects of premature obituaries who have dined out on it for the rest of their lives.
The long rest.
Cookie Hoogstrop, yes.
Cookie Hoogstrop.
I think her name was Cookie Hoogstrop. And, you know, reports of, you know, she has not yet been screwed into her coffin, she wrote in a postcard to the obits editor. They apologized profusely, and then there was an apology that appeared on the obits page, and then when she actually died, there was another obit, which meant that this poor woman had appeared on the obits page
a few times.
Three full times. I mean, that's like really for nothing else.
Christina, very, very great pleasure to have you here tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you both.